Hello?
Yeah, trying to get the music to play. All right, good evening, and thanks for tuning in to Noir on the Radio, where we celebrate gritty crime and noir fiction of all sorts. I'm Greg Barth, and I've got an exciting lineup for us tonight. A bit of a reunion show for you. It was just over a year ago. A group of accomplished noir authors joined together on this program to share some transgressive fiction in short form. The show was so well received, the writers enjoyed it so much, they've gotten back together to share a fresh batch of stories for us. And those writers are Eric Pruitt, E.A. Cook,
Howdy.
Dietrich Kaltes, Mary Miles, Michael Poole, and S.W. Lawton. So we got a jam-packed show, and I'm going to jump right in. Our first guest is Eric Pruitt. Eric is a screenwriter, author, and filmmaker living in Durham, North Carolina, with his wife, Lana, at Busey. His short films, Foodie and Lean on Command, have won several awards at film festivals across the U.S. His short fiction appears in the Avalon Literary Review, Pulp Modern, Thug Lit, to name a few. In 2015, he was a finalist for the Derringer Award for short story Knockout. His novel Dirtbags and Hashtag are available in ebook and paperback. He's host of the radio show The Crime Scene with Eric Pruitt and the Martha Barr series in Durham. A full list of credits can be found at ericpruitt.com. So, Eric, welcome back to Noir on the Radio.
Thank you very much, Greg, and thanks for having me on here. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, it's our pleasure. What we have queued up for us tonight, Eric?
I was down to the last minute here trying to figure out what I was going to read. I had two really good stories and one that's probably questionable. So like a real professional, I'm going to go with the questionable one. I wrote it for fun a while back called An American Werewolf in Dublin. And, so that's what I got. That's what you're in for.
Well, please take it away.
All right. Thank you. It's called An American Werewolf in Dublin by Eric Pruitt. All things considered, I thought the Yank looked a touch dodgy when he stepped off the bus. I sat with a couple mates at a pub just off Grafton and watched him maneuver the buskers and knackers. He was tired like, dark tea-colored circles behind his eyes and feet shuffling, barely stumbling over the curb. "Your mind looks crocked," said Doogie. He finished the rest of his ale and wiped head from his lips with his sleeve. "Worse than yesterday, right, Ma?" Ma's good eye flickered this way and that, but no telling if he saw him or not, swallowing the pint glass with his giant fist. Doogie told the truth. As the Yank fell into the one empty chair at our table, I couldn't help but notice how much more horrible he looked. Sweats like mad. Color run free from his face. Us Irish have fuck all for complexion, but this man stood bleached. White, say. He put a trembling hand to his forehead and wiped like mad, but still it remained swampy. His head rolled forth as if on a string freshly broken, then snapped upright again. A crust formed at the corner of his mouth, which seemed the only place on him high and dry. And he wheezed. "Where's the crack, Jimmy boy?" asked Doogie. He got no reply, just a weak smile from the Yank. He shrugged his shoulders. "Fetch you a pint, then." "Sure. Thank you." Doogie stood, but didn't step to the bar just yet. Instead said, "If you want my opinion, mate, it's all the black stuff you're drinking. That's not the number one reason, but it's pretty high up on the chart how it can tell you're a tosser from the States. You drink 3 or 4 pints and suddenly you're flubbered and need to fight off to the jacks. Then you forget to eat because that shite's like a full meal. It's no wonder you're manky." I laughed, but put a hand to the Yank's shoulders. "Doogie's having a laugh, but he's got a point," I told him. "You look knackered. Maybe you should head back to the gaff." "No," he croaked, his voice ragtag and raspy. "I'll be fine. It's just a little stomach thing." He sniffled and coughed, then said, "And that greasy food smell don't help none neither." I looked back and forth from Doogie to Ma. "What food smell? O'Brien serves no food, mate." "I smell kebabs," said the Yank. He put his hand to his stomach and held on for dear life. "And chips, like they're right next to me." Doogie said, "There's not a kebab stand for ages. Down at the quay. No, mate, nothing but cod shops and takeaways down here. How about a run and see about one of those tasty, frothy pints for you? Hair of the dog-like." And the Yank flinched. Suddenly it made sense. the light clicking above my head like one of those old cartoons with Woodpecker or Tomcat. "Didn't you get bit a couple days ago?" I asked him. "That knacker at Stevens Green, the one with the waster of the dog. Yeah, it's fucking diesel, right?" The Yank nodded weakly. "It wasn't nothing," he said. "I've been bit by worse." "Goes hand in hand with you buggered like you are," I said. I nudged Ma in the ribs. "Right, Ma." "Daft cunt," said Ma, as if up from a dream. Doogie returned with a pint of Guinness, set it before the Yank. "Drink up, mate. Smoke on a John Player and get started, because we've a big night in front of us. What time is it, Pard?" "Half two now," I told him, showing him my wristwatch. "The truck's leaving just shy of five." "What are you going to do with the money, mate?" he asked me. "Brother, I'll be on the piss for ages," I said. A smile shined in my own eye. "I spent the last of my wages on this suit of black clothes for tonight, but it won't wait until the last punt is counted before I'm telling that cunt behind the bar to pour me another." "And you, Ma?" asked Doogie. "What will you do with your share?" Ma's good eye found Doogie. The other rolled uselessly about the hole in his head. Ma smiled, or what I hoped was a smile, then returned his face to the pint glass. "Splendid," said Doogie. He turned to ask the same of the Yank, but took note of the poor bastard's skin color and thought better of it. Instead, he leaned back into his own chair. "I counted four magpie on the way over today, so there's no mistaking how this one will turn out. We'll be rolling in it. I've no use for these shinners and their politics, but at one stand I'm sure to make is for the note. The punt, mates. The royal fucking pound. Some cunts collect butterflies and the like, but not me, gents. I'll start a collection of paper bills, and I aim to start it tonight. They'll be rich, lads. Life no more will be veg and spuds, but bangers and rash and pints piled high to the fucking sky. And me, I'll sleep like a fucking baby." "Waking and screaming every 2 hours with a shite in your pants?" I asked. "Feck off." We had a laugh, and we finished our pints. With fuck all else to do, I suggested we leg it back to my flat. "What for?" croaked the Yank. "I forgot me torch." The Yank looked as if I were slagging, so I said, "The flashlight. I left it back in me gaff." "Fuck it," said Doogie. "Let's go without it. 'Twill be a full moon tonight to light our way to riches. Let's stick about and have one more piss." And so we did. It is just another drink. Another drink before the war. For what's one more night on this planet is poor, wretched men. The end.
All right. That was you needed to pause for some laugh tracks there. That was quite an accent you had. Good stuff.
Yeah, I told you a couple drinks will help.
Yeah. Well, you nailed the swear words and everything with the accent. You have me convinced that you were an Irishman there.
Thank you very much.
So good stuff, Eric. Oh, you're welcome. And you've got so much going on between filmmaking, radio, writing, hosting events. What's up and coming from Eric Foote, and what's the best way for folks to keep up with you out there?
I'm on the Facebook, the Twitter, the Instagram. If you're up at 3 o'clock in the morning and want to see pictures of me naked, you know, I'm on Snapchat, so you can jump on there. But Eric Pruitt, that's ERYKPRUITT.com, pretty much gives you the collection of all of them. So you can find me at any one of those things. But yeah, thank you very much.
Well, yeah, I highly recommend everyone check out Eric Pruitt. He's got some great stuff out there, from films to novels, and some great stories like you heard from him tonight. So Eric, thank you very much. Thanks for being on.
Thank you, Greg.
And next up, You're quite welcome. Next, we have E.A. Cook. Eddie Cook has lived a life that rivals the characters he writes about. As a young man, he spent years traveling around North America, covering 43 states and trips over the borders of Mexico and Canada. He traveled by boxcar, hitchhiking, and as a carny, traveling with 8 different shows off and on over 12 seasons. He's worked as a hot dog vendor, a face painter in New Orleans, and has been an account executive for print advertising, owned a private investigations company, and is presently an owner-operator of a taxi by night and a writer by day. He's the author of 2 novels, Spanish Moss and Taconite, and has been published in Muzzle Flash, Powder Burn, Silkworms, Parasitic, Flash Fiction Offensive, and Out of the Gutter, number 3. Eddie Cook lives in Fort Collins, Colorado. So, E.A. Cook, Eddie, welcome to Noir on the Radio. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I was looking forward to this.
Well, great. We all have. This is not sure who threw it out first to have the reunion show, but it was is a great idea, and I've really been looking forward to this one as well. What do you have on the docket for us tonight?
I have a short bit of Flash, 780-some words, a story called Coop. I will read it to you
hit
if you like.
Yes, sir.
Please Coop.
Do. Thank you.
October 5th, 1976. Coop died last Monday. I met him the day before in a tramp camp by the rail yard at Grants Pass. I just dropped out of an open box that I rode up from Klamath Falls and headed straight into the jungle in search of some wine and a roll-your-own. Coop was sitting on a log by a fire when I helloed the camp. He had wine and tobacco, but no papers. I had the papers, and a union of souls was born. He was older, so I listened to him tell his tales of living on the rails for 5 years. He was a West Coast tramp, never riding any other line but the North-South, Burlington Northern, and Union Pacific Railways. He liked the West Coast and said he never wanted to leave. He told me how he ended up on the skids. He never told me how he ended up on the skids, but I know now. He was larger than life to me. When he spoke, his education was obvious, as was his toughness. He had a great sense of humor, but occasionally got quiet and morose as we drank wine, smoked, and enjoyed a night around the fire. Two other tramps wandered into the camp, but saw that we were tuned into each other's rap, and eventually they found another place to land. It was after midnight when we polished off the wine, and we were both getting ready to lay out our bedrolls. "I'm all done, son," Coop mumbled, and then he handed me a map. "It's a treasure map, boy. Believe me when I tell you, that treasure has been a curse to me, ruined me. I can't go home to my family because of it, and without them, what have I got? What have I done?" He mumbled something else and turned his head, and I could see by the rise and fall of his shoulders that he was sobbing quietly. I took the map, and without looking at it, I put it in my pack and passed out on my bedroll. I was stone drunk, and so was he, and I didn't think much of it. Tramps drink, we tell stories, and we pass out. It's what we do. When I woke up, Coop was gone, but all his gear was still around the camp. It happened a lot. Some old road dog would wander off drunk in the middle of the night, but they always came back for their gear. Well, I stoked a fire and made some coffee in a soup can using a clean sock for a filter, and I smoked the stub of a cigarette while I waited for it to boil. I wanted to leave, but I didn't want to leave Coop's stuff for the vultures. I got up and I followed a path out to the yard, hoping I could catch sight of him, and I did, and I was horrified. What was left of him was on both sides of the fast rail that trains blew through town on. He had done it on purpose. I was sure of it. I thought back to what he had said before we'd passed out, and I knew he had ended himself. I had to get out of the area, not wanting to answer any questions from the local law. I went back to camp, removed the map that he had given me from my pack, and looked it over. It was simple and well-made and explained well how to get to a spot in the hills east of I-5, about 2 miles. He marked the spot with an X. It took me all day to get there, over rough country and two streams. Behind a thick grove of ponderosa pines growing up on the side of a hill, I found a small cave barely 3 feet high and 8 feet deep into the hill. Using my lighter for a torch, I crawled back into the cave and I found the treasure. It was a small duffel with a mother-of-pearl tie pin attached to the handle, and inside was stacks of money. I scrambled out of the hole and sat in the pine needle-covered forest floor and began counting. $123,000 and a newspaper clipping from 1971 with the headline, "Man Jumps from Commercial Airliner at 30,000 Feet. I read the article and grinned. I was going to miss D.B. Cooper. The end.
Oh, wow. That's pretty exciting, Eddie. So a lot of your travel by Boxcar and the like really seems to come through in that story. You know, how much of that is, you know, life as you lived it and experienced it?
That was, you know, outside of the guy getting cut in half and the $123,000, that was a pretty standard day. You jump off the train and look for another sign of life and share what you have and maybe catch the train together.
Yeah, good stuff. So, you know, what's upcoming from you these days? You know, you've got Vanish Moss and Taconite out, and you know, a ton of short stories out there. What's up and coming, and where can people find out more about E.A. Cook?
Well, I'm writing the sequel to Spanish Moss, and it's a lot darker and a lot more involved, and I really like it, and I'm excited about putting some more meat on its bones and getting it out to the public. My website is eacookwrites.com, and I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Although I don't get the Instagram, I don't get it, but I do it.
I follow people on Instagram, but I don't take a lot of pictures and put them on Instagram. But it's fun sometimes to go out and look at it. But the one I don't get is Twitter. Instagram, you know, I kind of get, but Twitter, it makes no sense to me. It just feels like I'm sending messages out into the void or something. But
I don't do well with change.
I'm sure it makes sense to some folks out there.
I don't do well with change, and I went into a small panic when we went from MySpace to Facebook.
Yeah. Well, you're on Facebook, so that's a good place for people to connect with you. And
yes,
eacookwrites.com.
Right.
Thanks, Eddie. Great story.
You bet.
And thanks for being on with us tonight.
You bet.
All right. Next up, we have Dietrich Kaltes. And I want to just double check and make sure. Dietrich, are you there?
Yep.
Okay. I wanted to make sure I'd brought the right person on one there. So, Dietrich, Publishers Weekly calls Dietrich Kaltes' third novel, Triggerfish, a fast-moving, high-octane page-turner. The National Post said his second novel, The Deadbeat Club, deserves to be something of a breakout for Kaltes. And Crime Spree magazine calls it gritty and raw, satisfying the need for all things dark. His award-winning debut novel, Ride the Lightning, was hailed as one of the best Vancouver crime novels. More than 40 of his short stories have been published internationally, and a screenplay Between Jobs was published in the Los Angeles Screenplay Festival. He lives with his family in Vancouver, B.C. So, Dietrich, welcome back to Noir on the Radio.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me back on. It's nice to be back with everybody, the whole gang.
You're welcome. Great to have you. I wasn't with you guys last year, but it's fun to be a part of this time around. What do you have queued up for us tonight?
Well, I'm going to read some of the first chapter of Triggerfish, my third novel, and if you want, I'll jump right into it.
Outstanding. Let's hear it.
Okay. Whoa, you see that? Renee Beckman told Danny Green to ease the cruiser around the corner. Experienced cop eyes catching a glimpse down the alley. Two guys at the back of the Christian bookstore, a van back to the loading dock, exhaust puffing from its pipe, middle of the night. 7 years on the force. Beck had it down in seconds. What's up, Danny said. Bet a Starbucks there's no King James in those boxes, Beck said. Killing the lights, Danny pulled to a stop. Beck getting out. Hand on the mic, Danny caught Beck's shadow along the top of the alley. Giving up on calling for backup, he flipped on his cap. He got out and went to the mouth of the alley, asking Beck how he wanted to play it. Go that way, was all Beck said, and he took off down the alley. Danny moved along the street. First time he might have to draw his piece. depending what was really happening. Felt the sweat under his arms. Around the east corner of the four-story, Beck unsnapped the holster, his Glock already drawn, safety off. Allowing his eyes to adjust to the dark, he stepped past the garbage, feeling his way along the bricks. At the back corner, he stuck his head out. Light from a street lamp gave him a bead on the two guys out back of the Jesus factory, a dark-colored Chevy van back to the dock, its engine running. The two guys were busy loading boxes, a security bulb over the open door, a crowbar against the wall, splintered wood sticking from the jamb, and both guys wearing hoodies. Coming up along the side of the dock with the Glock up, Beck kicked a can with his shoe. Both men turned, one guy dropping his box, hand going under his jacket. "Wouldn't do that," Beck said, had the guy point blank. Danny Green came around the other side of the dock, barking, "Police, freeze." Jumping up the steps, hand on his nightstick, Danny was going by the book, the force with force rule about to be his undoing. The guy still holding the box was shorter and turned to Danny, Danny telling him to set it down. Grabbing the other guy, Beck face-planted him against the bricks, taking his piece and dropping it in his own pocket, saying he wanted to see hands, yanking the guy's hood off. The one with the box hesitated as Danny stepped up, his hand on the nightstick. Tossing his box at Danny, let the Converse fly, jumping off the dock and running full out. Danny stumbled over the guns tumbling from the box and went after him. Snapping on the cuffs, Beck spun his man around, holstering his piece, asking for a name. "Got them kind of tight," the guy said, meaning the cuffs, smacking gum behind a stupid grin. Palming the guy's forehead, Beck bounced his skull off the bricks, the gum falling out. Beck asking, "That better?" The guy lost the cute, saying his name was Baldy Jones, throwing in, "But you got no cause." Bouncing his head again, Beck skipped the Miranda speech, saying he was arresting Baldy for being a thieving dickhead. Judging by the spilled guns and crowbar by the door, these two were robbing the real gun runners. Beck could hear Danny yelling freeze from somewhere down the alley. In pursuit, Danny sprinted, held a nightstick like he was in a relay race, the suspect refusing the baton. The guy jumped up the chain link at the end, scrambling over the razor wire. Staring up at the wire, Danny heard the guy's feet on the pavement, the fucker laughing. Slipping the stick into his duty belt, Danny walked back, thinking he should have pulled his piece, knowing the shit he'd catch from Beck. Coming around the corner, the loading dock lit by the single bulb, Danny caught Beck driving a fist into Baldy's middle and folding him up, the guy sinking to his knees, hands cuffed behind him. Baldy Jones was puking when the third figure sprang from the back of the van, Danny yelling, but too late. Beck got his hand on the Glock and was turning. The bulb over the door lit the face. A woman's, dark-skinned, her body pressing into him. He felt the blade go through the Kevlar. Beck grabbed at her, going limp, the breath leaving him, looking into her eyes. Screaming his name, Danny pulled his piece, the figure turning to him, her hood falling off. Danny firing a wild round and killing the single bulb, the night swallowing the scene. No chance for a second shot, and the woman was gone. Then Danny was cradling Beck's head, his own Glock down on the dock. Oh, Christ. Not sure what to do. Then fumbling with his handset, Danny told Beck to hang on, calling it in. That's it.
Great, Dietrich. That's an exciting start for Triggerfish. How would you describe this? Oh, you're welcome. How would you describe this book, you know, to those who, you know, maybe are hearing about it for the first time on this show? You know, then they're interested in checking it out and hearing more about this.
Okay. Well, when after that chapter, Rene Beckman quits the force. He's the one that was stabbed, and gets himself a charter boat and starts chasing salmon instead of crooks. And the story takes place here in Vancouver. And he comes across, he takes a date out on his boat, and he finds a secluded cove out past Bowen Island. And he's just about to enjoy a couple drinks and a barbecue and so on, and up pops this narco sub full of cocaine, and sort of spoils his plans. And that's sort of what sort of leads us into a story of him being pursued by a gang of the cartel crew from the sub, and a gang of bikers. So, you know, sort of trouble has a way of finding him, I guess. That sort of encapsulates the story, I guess.
Well, that's a good teaser. You know, for anybody hearing about this for the first time, you know, check out Triggerfish for sure. And where people find out more about you, Dietrich, and what's coming up next for you?
You can check me out on my website, dietrichkaltheis.blogspot.ca. There's information on my publisher's website. It's ECW Press. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, all that good stuff.
And books are available on Amazon.com, I'm sure?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you for being a part of the group tonight. And, folks, there you have it, Triggerfish. Check it out. It's just a mouse click away.
Thanks, Greg.
Next up, we have – you're welcome. Thanks. Next up, we have Marietta Miles. Marietta has published stories with Thrills, Kills, and Chaos, Flash Fish Offensive, Yellow Mama, Revolt Daily, and more. She has stories and anthologies offered through Static Movement Publishing, Horrified Press, and soon Gutter Books. Her first novel, Route 12, is now available through All Due Respect Books. Born in Alabama, raised in Louisiana, she currently resides in Virginia with her husband and two children. Please visit MariettaMiles.blogspot.com or Facebook for more stories and further information. Marietta, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Great to have you tonight. I've talked to you a lot through Facebook and email, and I've heard you on the show before, but I don't think we've ever actually spoke. So,
this is the first time.
I get to say hi. Yeah.
Hi.
What do you have in the pipeline for us tonight?
Well, this is actually super short, and as I've even edited it in the last hour. This is actually a piece that Flash Fiction Offensive actually published for me a while ago, and it was something that was really special to me, and I thought they were very nice to do that. And I'll go ahead and read it now. So, here we go. This is called Tell Her. Tell my mother I'm safe. Tell her things are not how I wanted, but as they simply turned out to be. Let her know at the end I felt the press of her strong arms around me, like when I was a kid. She would say her goodbyes in front of the school or at the door to the bright yellow bus, and she would break a sad smile when I squirmed away because I was so ready to grow up. Tell her I remembered. Tell her it was the warm, sugary smell of her hair and the familiar curve of her neck that I imagined while lying in the sticky dark, hollowed out, afraid, alone. Tell her the memory of her ferocious hugs and even her frustrated anger kept a tiny hole of hope inside of me until the very end. Tell her that I dreamed of coming home. Let her know, after a while, I barely felt his fingers, his hands, or any of the rest of him. Behind my closed eyes, I only pictured her face. She looked through our kitchen window and waved at me in the spotlight of a bright spring sun. It was his mean, greedy eyes I stared into during my long final hours, but let her know it was only her eyes that I could see. And though there is nothing left for my mother to bury or entomb, In some way, I will always be with her. Help her and all her worry, because what's done is done and nothing worse can come. Tell her I miss her and I'm sorry I couldn't stay. Tell her I love her and I'll always be her baby. And that's it.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you. Sorry,
so,
that was super
Marietta,
quick. Sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. We're making nothing wrong with short, and we are hosting a flash fiction show, so no issues with being brief. And I'm the kind of person, I would rather read The Ocean and the Sea than Moby Dick. So brevity is brevity is fine. And congratulations on Route 12. The couple novellas that you have out. Great. Both stories in there are just top notch in my book.
Thank you.
Where can people find out more about Marietta and what's up and coming from you?
Well, there's a couple of things I've got coming up, and I've been really fortunate. The community, the Noir community, is really helpful and kind, and they've come out, and I'm getting ready to do some reviews, which I'm excited about. I'm gonna take another look at Tom Pitt's re-release for Hustle, and I'm really excited about that because that's one of my favorite books. And also, Ed Amar has invited me to host the Noir at the Bar, the first one here in Richmond, so I'm going to be doing that. And I've gotten a whole bunch of wonderful writers, including you, who will be reading. So that's pretty fun, too. So we're thinking about something having to do with moonshine, make it fun. Make it stupid. It'll be awesome.
Moonshine is great. Yeah, I'm not. I've never been to Roanoke before, but I'm originally from that part of the country, Southwest Virginia. So I know a little about moonshine.
You'll learn about it.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you for putting that together. I know that
no
that takes a lot of work. Yep.
No problem. And so everybody can, I'll have more information up on my Facebook as soon as everything gets ironed out. So I would just, everybody look out for that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Marietta.
Mm-hmm.
And just a reminder, Noir on the Radio is a trademarked, copyrighted podcast, solely owned by the authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. And next up, we have Michael Poole. And Michael Poole needs to be taken off of mute, which I have just
done. Yeah, I'm here.
Michael, you're there? There you are. Michael Poole is the author of the crime noir novella Debt Crusher, as well as the collection of noir short stories New Alleys for Nothing Men. He's the co-editor-in-chief of Crime Syndicate Magazine and was the debut host for Noir on the Radio. Find him online at michaelpoole.net. Michael, when you guys had this show last year, do you host this group?
I did, yes.
I thought so. Yeah, that's really, really cool. I saw that you were the debut host, and about a year ago sounds right. So, what do you have to share with us tonight?
So, I had a story that I had prepared that was brand new, and I started reading through it and just really didn't like it. And so I was looking around frantically trying to decide what to read, and I realized I've never read the shortest story in my short story collection, New Alleys for Nothing Men. It's one part flash fiction. It's borderlines on a vignette, but it's pretty dark. When I was in my 20s, my dad spent most of my 20s in prison, and so I used to consider what that was like, and I ended up kind of writing this story about it. And so I felt like maybe I would read it tonight if I've ever read it out loud. And so I'll just go ahead and jump right in. The story is called Edict
Excellent.
From Nowhere. Okay, so Edict from Nowhere. You hear horrible things here at night. 35 years and I've never gotten used to the screams. There's so many things you see every day, degrading things. But it's the things you don't see, the things you can only hear while you try to sleep at night that burrow deep inside you. Sometimes not even being able to put a face to the terror, only a name. Higgins, Clark, Johnson, all of them dead now. Each having traveled through 20, 30, 40 years of living, only to end up sodomized and dead on a filthy concrete floor. When I first got here, I was scared to fucking death. I was 35 years old then, and I'm not too proud to admit I wept that first night. For the first couple years, I worked through every appeal there was. I still had dreams about life on the outside, my child back in her crib, my ex-wife standing on the sand of Stewart Beach in Galveston on the day we got married, smiling. I try not to think about those days anymore. You let people see weakness inside you here, and they'll gut you like an animal. Won't be nothing left of you but a number, maybe a bloodstain on the bathroom floor. Every last ounce of your life wasted and dripping down a prison drain. All you can do is get up, go to work, in the laundry, or in the fields. Get up and sleep and shit alongside the rest of them. Some of them are killers, but most just petty thieves and addicts. I've found that the best strategy is to walk tall and keep to yourself. If you let these boys see there's a heart in your chest, they'll make sure all you feel with it is pain. Most of them never learn to feel much of anything decent anyhow. Blame who you want for that. I've seen a lot of men crack. You have to learn to let go. Seems like people are determined to let go of everything in their lives except the horror. There's so much beauty in life, but nearly everyone ends up strangled by the ugly parts. Most days feel like watching and waiting for your turn. Some of them are men you've known for over 20 years before it happens. You learn to see it coming. They start to talk less. They spend less time interacting on the yard. Sometimes they just lay on their bunks all day, glass eyes staring into the nothing ahead of them like looking for fish beneath the water's surface, like the very thing that created them has finally been clean cut out. Knowing it's impossible to get away from all this cruelty causes a man to abandon hope after a while. On the one hand, maybe he regrets the things he's done in his life. On the other hand, he sees it doesn't make a load of horseshit to be sorry. Sorry is meaningless in here. If you tell someone you're sorry, they'll just call you con artist, liar, killer. You'll see in their eyes how much they hate you. My first cellmate, Carl Sanders, checked out by running up in the middle of the black section of the yard screaming, "Niggers, niggers, all of you." They stomped on his head until it burst like a rotten orange. Darnell Watkins climbed the fence on the yard one afternoon and screamed, "Get at me, bitch," to the guard in the tower. He was all tangled up in the razor wire on top of the fence when the first bullet hit around his kidneys. He thrashed and moaned as the wire sawed into his skin and let out his blood. The second bullet crashed into his left shoulder and came out through his chest. He would have dropped into the grass except he was all tangled up in the razor wire. Blood streaked down his forearms in long scarlet streams that turned his white jumpsuit red. Darnell, he just hung there and bled out with a crazed, vacant smile painted onto his face. Others have hung themselves, cut their wrists with sharpened scraps of metal, banged their heads against the cinder block walls until their minds were erased. Each one just another example of how much a man can come to resent the gift of life. There's no use even trying to understand that kind of loneliness unless you're forced to live with it. All of this hell spewing into your eyes every day, it gets to be too much. A man will wipe all memory of himself from this earth just to know he has something left to control. An existence that can be erased, even if his death means an anonymous grave in a field out back of hell. No flowers, no headstones. The flowers would be an insult anyway. Death doesn't need that kind of company. I'm tired most all the time now. My joints and muscles throb from 3.5 decades of sleeping on a foam mat. If someone had told me the day I got here that I'd still be alive this far in, I'd have called them a fool. I didn't think I'd survive a week, yet here I am. Every night I see the faces that have come and gone while I've remained. Faces consumed by violence, but also destroyed by the hopelessness of incarceration. Faces of men who dwelled on the past so long that it destroyed the present. Lifetimes of stories erased by the teller. Each of them alive in my mind and speaking their truths to me night after night until they start to make sense in the worst kind of way. The end.
Wow, that's nice and gritty. Thank you for that one, Michael, and thanks for sharing that with us tonight. Good stuff. Tell us a little bit about Crime Syndicate Magazine and what you're doing there.
So we've got two issues out. The first was guest edited by Eric Beatner. The second was guest edited by Dietrich Kaltais, who's here tonight. We've got a third issue that's going to come out probably the end of the year. I'm not really sure yet. Right now I'm kind of knee-deep working on an anthology that we're coming out with, a themed anthology that's going to be called fast women and neon lights, 80s-inspired neon noir, which actually features a few of you guys. I know you're in it. Dieter's in it. Steve's in it. Eric's in it. So quite a few of the alums from that are represented tonight.
Good stuff. Good stuff. And what's up and coming next from you? I know you've had a couple of things come out, Pressure and New Alleys for Nothing Men. What are you working on today?
You know, I'm putting the finishing touches on a novel called Texas Two-Step, which is it's about a couple of Texas boys in Colorado getting squeezed out of the weed market by illegal weed who decide to make one last run down to Texas to sell off their last crop and end up getting tangled up with a crooked sheriff and a bunch of other things like that. So I'm just finishing that up. Got a couple other things in progress, but right now mostly I'm just editing the anthology. There's 18 stories in it, so it's quite a bit of editing. So, yeah, just pretty mired in that.
A lot of work for sure. So where can people keep up with you at and what you have going on?
So you can find me online, www.michaelpoole.net. You can find Crime Syndicate Magazine at www.crimesyndicatemagazine.com. And you can find my imprint, which I'm using to publish the Fast Woman and Neon Lights anthology, Short Stack Books, at www.shortstackbooks.net.
Excellent. Well, Michael, thank you for coming on with us tonight. Stick around, and we'll all be able to chat a bit more.
Thanks for having me.
Next, we have you're quite welcome. Next up, we have S.W. Lawton, Steve Lawton's debut novel, Bad Citizen Corporation, available from Rare Birds, and the second in Greg Salem novel, Grizzly Season, we published in 2016. A standalone novella, Crosswise, is available now from Down and Out Books. Steve Lawton, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Greg, thanks so much for having us back on.
Oh, you're quite welcome. This has been a real treat. What do you have prepared to share with us tonight?
Well, I actually decided to read for the first time the first piece of flash fiction that I ever published, which was with Akashic Books for their Mondays Are Murder series. It's actually a character study for the sidekick Marco from my debut mystery novel, Bad Citizen Corporation. And since the second book in that series, Grizzly Season, is going to be coming out in October, I thought I'd give this one a try.
Excellent. Let's hear that.
All right, great. So just an FYI, this story takes place in the 90s, so I do an awful lot of talking about compact discs, if you guys remember what those are. This is called
I still have a
Swinging
few,
Party. Yeah, this one's called Swinging Party. Marco was always pretty smart for a drummer. He knew the record shop wouldn't be open at 3 a.m., so he headed straight for the back door. The teenage punks that worked there often forgot to lock up at the end of the night. If he was lucky, he could get out with an armful of CDs in a couple of minutes. His dealer was usually open for barter until sunrise. He wiped his nose with the sleeve of his hoodie as he approached. A slight ocean breeze kicked up and blew a few strands of stringy hair in front of his sunken eyes. The motion light came on overhead, casting sharp shadows across his gaunt face. He glanced nervously at the empty alley that faded into darkness in both directions. It was only the unbearable itch that compelled him to take the next step. The door opened a crack as soon as he touched the knob. He muttered thank you to nobody in particular and entered. There was a light on in the small office to his right. He shut the door and listened, studying the hundreds of punk rock flyers that lined the hallway. Black Flag, Descendants, Bad Religion, Social Distortion, Agent Orange, Pennywise. It was a photocopied memorial to all the bands that had influenced his life since junior high. He poked his head around the corner and was relieved to find the office empty. It wasn't the owner Tim that he was worried about, but his little brother Greg. The three of them had spent years together in a van on an endless U.S. tour, along with their bass player, JJ. That was a couple of years ago now, but Marco had never met a more violent person before or since. Where Tim was the kind of guitarist who preferred to face his amp, Greg was the lead singer who was always starting a riot. The dynamic worked better on stage than backstage. Marco gave the cluttered office a quick scan. The cash box wasn't in plain sight, which meant it was probably locked up in the safe. Or maybe they left it behind the counter again, he wished as he headed into the shop. It looked the same as it always did in the middle of the night. A watery yellow glow was coming through the windows from the streetlights out front. The towering racks and bursting bins looked like an industrial landscape silhouetted in the crowded space. He took a couple of steps inside and immediately started rifling through the new arrivals. He knew his dealer's taste ran towards pop punk, so he set his sights on The Offspring, Blink 182, and Green Day. Anything more than that, and Tim might finally catch on to his late-night raids. 5 new CDs had a street value of about $20, which was enough to get him through until morning. He pulled a plastic shopping bag from his pocket and shoved the loot inside as he walked toward the counter. His forehead bumped into something that shouldn't be there. Marco looked up and had to duck when he saw the white tips of Converse sneakers coming back his way. He fell flat on the floor and watched the sole swinging gently back and forth. The rope made a sickly creaking sound as the weight of the body strained the beam overhead. Marco rolled to his side and stared up in horror at Tim's bulging, lifeless eyes. Marco sprang to his feet and wrapped his arms around Tim's leg, trying desperately to take the weight off his friend's neck. But Tim's limp frame just folded and contorted in response. It was useless. He was already gone. Marco pushed himself away. Tim was swinging wildly now, from side to side at first, and then, eventually, in ever-narrowing circles. Marco bent down and clutched the plastic bag in his hand. He grabbed a record-cleaning rag and wiped down everything he had touched. The motion light came on again as he stepped outside. He pulled the door shut and polished the knob. His footsteps echoed down the alley as he ran off to score. The end.
Great. So first published flash fiction piece from Steve Lawden. Good stuff.
Uh-huh.
So,
thank you.
Steve, you've got – you're welcome. So you've got Grizzly season coming up in October. Tell everybody a little about that.
Well, so if you read my first novel, Bad Citizen Corporation, it's about a former punk musician who becomes a police officer later in life, and he's sort of dealing with the way that those two worlds collide as he's closing in on 40 years old, and he ends up shooting a kid while on duty and losing his badge. So that's Bad Citizen Corporation. Grizzly Season picks up where Bad Citizen Corporation left off, and Greg and Marco are up in the Angeles National Forest, which is a huge public space behind L.A. in the San Bernardino Mountains, and they discover an illegal marijuana growing operation and get sort of entangled with a guy who's basically leading a cult up in the mountains.
Great, that sounds very exciting. So it comes out in October of 2016, and what else is up and coming? Where can people keep up with you, Steve?
Well, I actually just did some updates to my author website, so you can find me and information about me and my books and things I'm up to at swlauden.com. So that's swlauden.com. And then I also do weekly author interviews on my blog, which is badcitizencorporation.com.
Good stuff. I read your interviews regularly. I can't keep up with those. They come through on Facebook, and I'm always intrigued to, you know, read those and see what people are saying and just get to know the writers out there a little better. It's definitely good stuff. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much, Greg.
So, guys, it has occurred to me that, you know, you've been together a little over a year ago on this program, and you've probably kept in touch ever since, but maybe not had the entire group together like we do tonight. And I think this is a good opportunity. If you have questions for one another, if you maybe want to learn more about Eric Pruitt's Irish accent or find out more about Crime Syndicate. I'm going to open it up here for a few minutes and just, you know, see if you guys have anything to say to each other, questions or topics you want to bring up.
Oh, I got some things to say.
Well, let's hear it.
Am I going to need a cigarette for this?
No.
So it sounds like maybe not. And if that's the case,
everybody went to get a cigarette.
Everybody went to get a cigarette. Well, that's okay. I wouldn't want to close the show out without giving everybody a chance to say hi and catch up. But maybe you've been doing that all along. Well, folks, there you have it. You know, to all of our writers, Eric Pruitt, E.A. Cook, Dietrich Kaltis, Marietta Miles, Michael Poole, S.W. Lawton, thank you so much for joining us on Noir on the Rio this evening. And to the listeners, I encourage you to check out the works available from each of these writers, just a mouse click away, and you won't be sorry. They're some of the best in the genre. And this is Greg Barth, your host, wishing you a great night of noir reading, and until next time.
Thanks, y'all. It was a good time.
Yeah, cheers, y'all.
Thank you.